Welcome back to Stacking Growth. This is Cassidy. Carl, how you doing?
Oh, we're doing good, Cassidy. Thanks for having me.
always. Love that you're here every single time, so I appreciate it.
I just keep getting the invite. I'm not sure how I keep earning this invite, but I'm here, man, so I'm pumped.
I'm still hoping you earn it. I have trust in you.
So. Nice.
All right, man. Let's welcome our guest, Dan Sanchez. Dan, how you doing?
Doing well. Thanks for having me on.
Dan, I mean, I don't even know how to introduce you. We go way back to your days at Sweetfish, which I used in the past and was instrumental in kind of getting our first podcast off the ground at a different company. Now you're director of inbound marketing at Element 451, and you also have your own side business around audience growth, which we want to get into. What did I miss? Like, what else are you doing?
I mean, that's kind of it. I have my personal brand, of which people know me as Dan Chez. So that's a thing. And then I'm working at Element 451. And then like just before we're on this call, I mean, obviously we're talking about homeschooling kids. So that's kind of my other life offside podcasting and what I'm doing on LinkedIn. All my time goes there, the personal brand stuff, and then Element. That's my life.
Working family, man.
I got a question about Dan real quickly about like that transition, right? So, cause you're newish in your role and it's a pretty big like shift in industry. You were doing stuff with Sweetfish. You were like their executive producer. Obviously you were in that world, helping lots of different companies. And now you're doing, you know, demand for and marketing for, you know, it looks like a CRM for the education space.
Yep.
That feels like a dramatic pivot in your career. Like walk us through that really quickly, like how you thought about that, how you decided on something like that, and like how it's going.
Yep. I have a habit in my career of shifting between agency and in-house. I've done this a few times now, and I tend to get dissatisfied working for one for too long. Right? Because you work in-house, but then what happens is you become the expert, the all-knowing person on marketing. Right. And then you're just hungry to learn. You start feeling yourself plateau. So you go work for an agency and dang, you're working with some solid marketers now. You're cooking. But you start to fatigue in a different way because you're learning all this new stuff and you're applying it across dozens of clients. And at Sweetfish, we were working primarily with B2B SaaS, though B2B generally. And I got to a point with Sweetfish where I'm like, I'm learning all these sweet things about podcasting and audience growth, but you know how it is working for an agency. Refine Labs is an agency. Yeah. Sometimes you can only get clients to move like a few steps up the ladder. And you're kind of like, come on, if we could only go to the top rung, this could be so good. What if? What happens? I start getting this hunger to go in-house again. You're like, well, if it has to be, it's up to me. I'm going back being that solo marketer. Not an Element, I'm not the solo marketer. I sat down in probably December, January, I started feeling that itch again. And I love Sweetfish. James Carberry has freaking changed my life, man. We're great. He's a great friend to me and have been a huge role and advocate for me from the beginning. But I was starting to talk to them about, moving on and what that would look like. I had to think like, if I'm going to move and go in-house again, where is it going to be? You know, so you start to walk down the process. I'm like, I knew I wanted to work in tech, specifically SaaS. Because that's where I'd been working at, who I've been working on with Sweetfish, like all the clients where I had the most experience. But I'm like, okay, but what vertical? We had a hypothesis at Sweetfish that SaaS is going to move vertical, that's going to be where the growth is. Right now it's a little slow, but I'm predicting over the next 10 years that it's going to swing back from horizontal to vertical because tech goes through cycles. Like we've seen this over and over again. The pendulum's going to swing back. It always does. And then it'll go back horizontal again eventually. Who knows how? But it's moving vertical. So I picked higher education because I'd spent, 6 years as a director of marketing for higher ed. And before Element existed, I was rigging together small business CRMs because that's what we could afford. And I made those things freaking sing for that college and we tripled enrollment. So I knew it's nice to be a marketer of something where you can understand and empathize with the audience, right? So that was a strategic choice. I know it'd also be easier to get the job because they would see the role of being a marketing director for higher ed as a plus, right? Yeah. Instead of a negative. If I were to go into fintech, they'd be like, well, that doesn't count for you. That doesn't count as years of experience for you. So strategically, I knew that would just get me a role faster and actually count for my work.
Yeah, it's really interesting you You mentioned that in your journey. We just had the CMO of Splash, Kate, on the show, and she'd also gone back to her industry after being away for a while. And so I'm curious, as you're going through this thought process to leave and you're looking at verticals and you're looking at higher ed, how much of it was, I have experience there so I can accelerate the ability to find a job and my growth versus like I have a passion for it as well. Was both. It kind of both?
Yeah, I love education. I actually struggle with traditional education, even for my own college. I found a weird university that just let me like jump to the final test on almost every class. I mean, I earned my bachelor's degree in like 8 months and then my MBA in 6 months because that program lets you go as fast as you're capable of or know how. Of course, some you don't know all the subjects, so those slow you down. But I love education. Obviously, like even if you're watching the video, I have like this big bookshelf and that's just one. I have another one over here just full of books because I love freaking learning. And I find that people who work in higher ed also love learning, you know, just makes sense. So I like working in the industry, and a lot of people over there are hungry for change. Don't know what to do though. It's slow. And even taking things that are like just best practices over in tech land and bringing it over into higher ed, you just look like a rock star, man. So easy turf. I understand it. And I have a passion for it. So it's kind of a combination of both, knowing that it's a good market and I like it.
Yeah. So I came from like the nonprofit before Refine, before HubSpot. I sold like nonprofit CRMs and CMSs to like big mega churches and nonprofits like Billy Graham Crusade, like stuff like that. And I think there's a lot of similarity, right? Because those are like legacy. I guess I think of the, maybe you think of these the same way, Dan, but like, I think of like those like legacy kind of companies. They're still like 15 years behind like HubSpot and Sweetfish and Clary and Refine Labs. And so it is enticing to go and potentially step back into a legacy industry and be like a rock star because like, I mean, you can go in and do so much damage fairly easily because there's so much work and just, marketing debt, you know, like I'm trying to find the equivalent of like technical debt for like go to market technical debt, you know, that it's fun to make big, big leaps and bounds. Whereas you go to like a really cool, like SaaS company, like let's say I go to, you know, be a sales leader, like Chili Piper, you go to Chili Piper or somebody that's like pretty like modern, right? It's like the transformation and the change is more instrumental. You're probably not going to go and like install a podcast and it's going to be like this huge groundbreaking thing. It's like they're already doing a ton of those great things and it's working. So like the change is more incremental. So I would assume like a little bit less exciting. So that resonates with me, just kind of that desire to go back into education for a couple of different reasons.
Dan, I got a lot of questions I could ask here. One would be though, maybe, and I got a thread, but one is explain more about this thesis that you had with James that the SaaS industry would verticalize. I'd love to hear kind of a little bit of thought process there. And that kind of, I think, led also to, you know, you looking at your next gig by industry and by SaaS, because you're probably looking at what industry do I want to be in? And my hypothesis is SaaS verticalizes. And that's what we're dealing with, the CRM for education, which is a vertical SaaS application. So maybe thinking through this journey, this hypothesis seemed to have a big impact on your decision-making. And where did that come from? I'd just love to hear it.
I mean, part of it is we're all marketers here and we all understand the game of advancing your career as a marketer is picking the right horse. It doesn't matter how good of a jockey you are if you're picking a bad horse in a bad market, right? So ultimately, that's what I'm picking. I'm trying to pick the right company in the right industry that I know is poised for growth. And I think we were seeing a lot of trends of vertical just becoming better because it's getting easier to build the system, right? Like what used to be hard and used to be just like only Salesforce could do that level of complexity. Well, now people are creating all these crazy tech frameworks to make it easy to duplicate what's in HubSpot can now just be duplicated on its own with less staff and be just as robust. Like an element, the more I go through the product, the more I fall in love with it because it's literally has some of the more advanced features that I could do with like Marketing Cloud or Salesforce. But now I don't have to have these really cumbersome systems that can accommodate for almost everything, but now it can just be set up and ready to go just for my niche. In fact, it was the biggest lesson I've learned over the last month is like everything I built for the college that I used to work for, it's all gone now. I documented the heck out of that thing and I had training systems. I even left behind somebody that knew the system, but eventually they left. They couldn't maintain it. It had to be rigged to fit a college model and it worked, but it didn't work for long. Eventually it started falling apart. But when you have a vertical system, they not only know how to support you better, right? They know the customer success is all element is all focused on just colleges, right? They have the same struggles over and over again. The tool can be accommodated just for applicants, right? And that's powerful and it's worth leaning towards rather than Salesforce. So that's playing out across multiple industries now, which is why a veterinarian's going to buy a CRM specializes in veterinarians. Why a dentist is going to buy a CRM that specializes in the appointment settings loop that dentists get into, rather than a generic small business CRM that can do that, but only with a lot more effort and something that the customer success people aren't armed with to understand the nuances of the problems. So I think because the tech's gotten easier to do and create, all these verticals are starting to pop up. It actually, James got the insight from a VC that started talking about it. And as soon as James passed the information to me, I was light bulb went off and I'm like, that's it. And just because if you've been around tech long enough, you know, the pendulum swings between these two things over and over again. You're like, uh-huh, this is a thing.
Yeah. And I think you make a really astute point. Not only does the pendulum swing back and forth, but the barrier to entry is dramatically lowering for the technology we're dealing with. Yep. And now it's only accelerating. Like you can imagine this world of AI and stuff that's coming our way.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the ability to do these things in a verticalized manner will only increase. That's fascinating. I'll have to think about that, Carl. I'm not sure we're going to do with that information, but it's a good insight.
Yeah, I mean, I saw that
it's a little early.
I saw that when I was at HubSpot, right? So I was the salesperson that was trying to sell you like the general CRM, and I used to always go up against like these little niche. I mean, there's so many little CRMs for like HVAC companies and plumbers, and I used to go up against all of those. And I mean, selfishly, I've always even thought about you know, being a founder of one of these, because like maybe you're not going to become like the $100 billion company, but man, in a niche, there is $50 million in CRM revenue that you could capture, you know, or $100 million in one of these niches. You just have to go in and understand those businesses. And then the thing is, like, especially in the CRM space, it's like the CRMs are, they're 80% the same. I don't know if like Dan would agree with this, but like the core is this contact records, account records, company totally. Records. Like a lot of it's the same. But it's like those hyper specialized, verticalized, like modules, add-ons, features that really make those platforms sing.
Hundreds of little details make the difference, right? Hundreds of little details. Yep. It's why I don't do Android phone. I hate all the little details. The big features are all the same.
Yep.
I can't stand all the little details of Android, yep. So I use an iPhone.
Yeah.
Makes a difference.
I love it.
So let's overlay kind of this, the journey that you're on here with kind of the other thing that I've noticed that you're passionate for around audience growth. And I really saw this bubbling up again back in the Sweetfish days. Not only yourself, but I think you and James really started going down this path of the emphasis and the focus on audience, which I thought was awesome. And you've kind of taken it from there. So like, how did,
how did that become a thing?
Yeah. How'd that become a thing?
That became the thing because of James. And it's really because of James's insight into the market that people just don't want a podcast. They don't want a podcast. They want an audience. That is the core thing. So I literally came into Sweetfish as the marketing director, but he had the insight to give me the title director of audience growth because that's what clients care about. And at the time I was like, whatever, you're the boss. I don't care about the title. So I'll run with that title. Over time, I started to recognize the power of it. So James actually like set me up for that. But I wrestled, every marketer knows, like it, I feel like it's better to be a generalist. It's my conclusion now. And the specialist versus generalist debate, your actual execution skills should be generalist. And I don't mean like kind of know everything, like actually be able to execute as many of the verticals, you become a more powerful marketer. You know, if you know the intricacies of PPC, SEO, social, if you know how to do those well, it's powerful. But we all know the positioning problem of that. If you can't be known for one thing, you have a problem with a personal brand, because generalist, yeah. What is he? oh, he's a marketer. Yeah, he does marketing things. What does that mean? What kind of problems does Dan solve? That's a hard thing to know. So I was posting on LinkedIn about all kinds of marketing things. And I just found that the people that specialized, their personal brands went farther. And honestly, I started to find that I started, just because I was helping so many clients with it, gaining an extra skill set around audience growth, which is more than just how to grow podcasts organically. It was really like, how do you bring a full mix to grow an audience? How do you use paid? How do you use owned? How do you use earned in order to grow one channel? And it started obviously growing with even more. How do you grow a LinkedIn following? How do you do a following on YouTube? How do you do a following on different places? So it started to build an expertise. And then maybe even only in the last year have I started going hard on it with my personal brand and now launching out a Sweetfish. My goal is to continue to publish and be as helpful as possible around how to build an audience, but also do it for Element 451. This is my ultimate thing, that my goal, Element 451, is to find a SaaS brand, build an audience, make it super successful. And that becomes the case study of like, I want to work with more companies to do this thing.
Question for you, Dan, where do you feel like, because I feel like every company's like wants like an audience, right? And wants to grow their audience. Like I've never met any, you know, business professional that doesn't want to do that or doesn't have that as a goal. Like, where do they go wrong with it? What are like some of the big mistakes that you see companies or marketing leaders make that just prevents them from, you know, growing their audience to kind of its fullest potential?
The biggest problem most people run into is right at the beginning. Like, they never even have an audience to begin with beyond the paid list that they're getting and the people that don't unsubscribe right away. Like, that's their audience. That's currently what we have for Element 451, is kind of like this email list that got cobbled together from a bunch of different places, and we keep sending them emails. And then we have a certain percentage of them that for some reason haven't unsubscribed. That's their audience. But that's really starting without an audience. So there's that problem. And then there's another problem where people have an audience, but they've hit what I call the audience growth ceiling. Like, they can't get beyond this plateau for some reason. And there's some basic math that's causing that to happen for them. But the first one is definitely they haven't even really gotten anything started to begin with. And I actually find that everything you learn as an entrepreneur applies to audience growth in the beginning. So take your lean startup methodology and just apply that to audience growth. Instead of product market fit, your real goal should be media market fit. Put on your media company hat and pretend like you don't have a product and that you have to make money by getting an audience. What do you need to do? You need to grow an audience by throwing out, you have to have a hypothesis on what kind of content is going to resonate with a certain kind of person. And then you have to test that, post. Oh, there is a hit, iterate, test, post, and, you know, and grow it slowly and organically, because you're trying to find a media market fit before you can go into scaling an audience, which is what a lot of companies, they just start doing content marketing and then they throw it out there, but they don't iterate. They don't do what creators do on platforms like YouTube and TikTok, right? If you go to any early days of any creator, you see it happening. You see them testing out different ideas, and then you see they have certain hits, right? You could see them thinking through, like, how do I capitalize on what's working? And they start to change their style, change what's resonating with the audience. So that's the problem most companies run into, is they don't treat it like an entrepreneurial endeavor with the hypothesis that they're testing rapidly. And I've now that I'm in a SaaS company, I'm starting to run into some of the reasons for that. There's short-term, like quarterly pressures to hit numbers. There's approval processes for every single piece of content. There's leaning too heavily on sales and paid media in order to make the goal. So we're scrambling to test creative all the time, and it looks like everybody else is creative because we're looking at our competitors instead of just going straight to the audience for feedback. So all those things keep people from actually being lean to test lots of different ideas to actually get to media market fit.
So maybe
that's the biggest problem we have in the early stage.
That's awesome. And I love those reasons, because I was going to press you on like, why though? Why? Because I know everybody wants the audience and everybody knows that they should be iterating, but what really prevents a team, smart people, right? Good marketers from doing that. And I think you nailed some of those reasons there at the end, right? Short-term goal mindset, et cetera. So how do you, maybe you haven't done this yet, Dan, you're still early days at Element 451. You're in the process of this. How do you break off of that hamster wheel? How do you get out of that kind of cycle? What are some of your hypotheses around how a company would do that? How do you plan on doing that?
Well, so far I'm running into two problems at Element that I'm still working towards overcoming, because if you turn it too fast, then the whole team doesn't go with you. And, you know, so it takes time to like have change management go through, because the cycle that we're in didn't come out of nowhere. So you have to take everybody with you very slowly. We are spending almost, I'd say, all of our leftover time or our marginal time, promoting webinars like every other SaaS company. As I've checked in with other friends, I find that this is the common thing. We're very webinar focused. Webinars have a lot of inefficiencies in them, and I'm doing some things to fix that. The other problem is I think we're spending all of our paid media budget on the bottom of the funnel instead of using it to accelerate our audience growth. So those are the first two things that I'm tackling right now, is coming up with a different strategy for paid media and trying to streamline webinars. They for sure won't let me stop webinars, right? So most people probably run into that. Like, we have to do webinars. I'm like, okay, but can, instead of crafting every email custom, can we have just lean on Zoom's built-in email reminders? So that's one thing that I've done, is just, let's just lean into Zoom, because they send out a lot of these emails and we're spending a lot of time on every single email and then running it through the approval process where it's coming back down the ladder multiple times to get approved. I'm like, we could be making content this time. And the team wants to work on content. That's the funny thing. And the senior leaders want to work on content. They don't want this stuff happening. So we're changing that. We're simplifying webinars so that they're done at the same time every single month, instead of just always picking a different time. So it's like, nope, from now on, it's going to be the first Wednesday at 1 p.m. Eastern every single month. We're going to start coming up with the content calendar way ahead of time so that we can kind of systematize it and eliminate everything we can. One of the biggest books that have impacted my career as a marketer is Tim Ferriss's 4-Hour Workweek. Everything he has in there has made me a better marketer. Even though he's using it to escape the grind, I'm using it to like level up in my work, right? So he goes through, what can you just eliminate? Just completely get rid of. Anything you can't eliminate, automate. Anything you can't automate, delegate, right? Which means you have to actually type up with the process of a, you know, and if all these if then statements for people to follow to know what to do so that you can hand it off and know that it's getting done well every single time. So I'm in the process right now of eliminating, automating, and delegating to the team so that the webinars become streamlined, instead of becoming 80% of the time, become 10% of the time, freeing up the time to then work on podcasts and the things that actually drive actually have a little bit more of a flywheel. Webinars don't have one. Right?
Yeah.
If I do a webinar well, I have to start all over from scratch every time.
Yeah.
Because I'm going to fatigue my email list over and over. Versus a podcast, if I do it well, again, maybe my subscribers grow and they stick around longer, and then it can grow. My audience can grow. Where does your webinar audience grow? It doesn't. It's a bottom of the funnel tactic. It works, especially in higher ed. They love webinars for some reason. So I'm like, okay, I'll keep doing it. That's cool. And then I'm also just refining our paid media strategy to, instead of focusing on everyone at the bottom of the funnel, I'm just going to narrow it down to just a few decision makers, save a lot of budget, and focus that at the top of the funnel with content, with getting people to subscribe to a newsletter, getting people to subscribe to a podcast. Because just like Chris Walker says all the time, like, most people aren't in the buying stage. So you have to nurture the relationship and build affinity with people way ahead of time. That's kind of like the long-term game plan. But right now I've got to throttle back paid media and refocus it and streamline webinars.
Dan, talk to me. Cassie, I promise I'll let you talk sometime in this podcast, but Dan,
Cassie, you're just sitting back.
Like the, you said something in the very beginning of that, that spiel, which was awesome, about like change management and people that you need to bring along with you. And then you said something else interesting. You said like, well, the executives want to be doing more content. My team wants to do more content, but there's like laggards in there. So like, how are you, and I want you to talk through your process here, because, you know, Cassidy and I talk to a lot of, you know, buyers and stuff that come inbound, and the biggest challenge that I find that they face is change management. They want to change, you want to change, but you got to bring so many people along with you. It's really, really difficult. Talk to me about how you are, who do you find? So two questions here. Who do you find is the most difficult to change, or maybe the slowest? And then how are you working through that kind of change management, you know, internal transformation process?
I don't know. I feel like that's going to be different in every company. Like, it might be the CRO, it might be the CEO. So far I think I've been really lucky. And I was also like, during the interview process, I was putting out fillers for where I'd be running into obstacles ahead of time. Yeah. And it's one of the reasons why I chose Element, is because I had a ton of alignment with the VP of marketing that I report to, everything I throw to her, she's like, yes, amen, let's go. Right. The CRO is also a great CRO, and the CEO had, I could tell, already loved podcasting and had a vision for where I wanted to go. So now I'm literally just working through a lot of details and misconceptions and miscommunications. Like I, like with the webinar stuff, all the custom emails we're doing, it took me a couple of weeks just to figure out why we were doing it. Cause you know, you talk to the team, the team's like, oh, well, this person said, and I talk to that person, be like, oh, well, that comes from the CEO. So I finally get a hold of the CEO, and the CEO is like, what are you talking about? Right. You're like, he's like, I didn't ask for all that, but I'm like, but you said here, he's like, oh, like, that's not what I meant. Oh, and why did we make this thing here? Oh yeah, I made that. But now that you're talking about it, you're right. We can automate it all through Zoom. I don't really care about that. Oh, cause some other people thought that you cared about that. And that's why we did it that way. So it's really just coming in and trying to bring a lot of clarity, and trying to find out very carefully what people are more passionate about than others. I don't want to step on people's toes. So again, change management, it's lots of conversations. It takes a little bit longer. Like you wish you could change everything in 2 weeks, but honestly, it's probably going to take a few months, maybe not enough to meet all the goals I have for this quarter, which is kind of like where I'm at now. Like, hey, it's like expectations on goals, change management. If we want to be slow and steady and changing things so that we don't like flip the ship upside down while we're trying to turn it, you know, we might not make as high of a goals as we were hoping for, which is the conversations I'm in now. But I've definitely worked for CEOs in the past that are like unyielding in their opinions and would not even let you hear out, will not hear out your argument without getting angry. Luckily, that's not what I'm running into at Element. They're pretty cooperative and everybody's moving with me on things. So, but it's part of what I was looking for in the interview process.
It's awesome.
Yeah, just a side note there, and you said it at the end, I think it's fundamental you figure these things out in the interview process. You hear a lot of marketers just lament about the situation you just outlined. It's never been more important to figure this out before you start the job. So well done.
It's hard to figure out though. Like what would you tell, there's so many red flags that you've developed a skill set for them because you've been burned by them. It's only until you're mid career, until you really start to look for some things that you didn't even know at the beginning of your career to ask. Right.
Yeah. It's kind of like your kids. You can do your best to kind of pass along your wisdom based on your experience. They're only going to listen to so much until they figure it out themselves. Right. So I agree. It's very hard to, it's easy to conceptually understand. It's hard without going through it and experiencing it to figure it out in real time. So my question then is, we get a lot of, I mean, I think a lot of individuals or companies would love to build an audience and don't know how. And so I'd love for you to walk through kind of your framework for doing that. Because I do think a lot of people start with, hey, can you help me launch a podcast? And I think it's very insightful for you to say, listen, what we don't really want is a podcast. We actually want an audience. And that is true. So how do you think about that either at an individual level? Like Carl would love to build a bigger audience. Have you seen his? It's not that good. For a company, like it could be a company that you're starting from the beginning, like Element. It could be a company like Refined Labs where it's somewhere on the journey. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on just what's your framework for tackling this.
When I was meeting with clients for Sweetfish, one of the first things I tried to figure out is who are we talking about? Like who is the audience? And trying to get as narrow as possible of who that was. Because the more narrow you can make it, the better you can make the content, right? If you're trying to satisfy everybody, you're always going to end up going to the middle of vanilla content. Because if you're trying to satisfy too many people with one blog, the more you're going to just dumb it down to the point where it's not even interesting anymore. And that's sad. So I would always try to get them to be like, okay, what's our target? How narrow can we make it? I know you serve three industries, but if one industry hit hard, like which one pays you the most, you know? Which ones has the best margins that you see the most growth potential for? Because we're only going to target one. I wasn't always successful on getting them to that point because sometimes they just have to target all three industries and they're like wildly different. You're like, oh gosh. but if I can get them to narrow in on just one, that's another reason why vertical solutions are going to win is because they can build an audience way easier. You know how much easier it is to build an audience around higher ed and tech than it is just like multiple industries? It's going to be way easier for us than it is HubSpot. And I only need a small audience to win compared to HubSpot. Like an email list of 6,000 people. My TAM only has 6,000 schools. Like it's not going to be that, it's going to be much easier. So you narrow in on the audience, and then you, of course, like every good marketer knows, you got to talk to the audience to figure out what is the problem. Like, and that's why I love podcasting. I usually recommend going after a two channel strategy, with podcasting being the one. You could do this with YouTube. You could do this with blogging. I just find podcasting to be simpler and easier to execute and can fuel the other two. So podcasts, and for B2B, of course, LinkedIn. So those are the two channels that I go all in on. And I try to get people to ignore all the other channels. Don't do Twitter. Don't even post to it. Instagram, forget about it. We got to get at least an audience built up on two before we can go to three. And just by creating focused, again, eliminate everything else, automate what you can, and then delegate. Like, you got to go through the steps of freeing up enough time to really hit these two channels hard. You need a short form channel and a long form channel. So unfortunately with podcasts, there's not a lot of discoverability built in, which means you have to get it from somewhere else. With most companies, I'd also talk about like paid media and how to get that going too. But if you're starting from scratch, you have to focus on those two channels. Talk to the audience, figure out what their pain points are. If you don't know what those are, then just start interviewing them on your podcast. I often try to sneak in questions into the back of the interview that are like your rapid fire questions for short answers, and make those questions like, what's the biggest struggle your team's running into this quarter? What's the biggest win you've had in the last year? What does your boss care most about? Who influences your work the most? Where do you hear from them? The answers to those questions are freaking gold. And if you just ask the same people the same questions over and over again, and interview your ideal buyers, one, you can build relationships with them because they might become customers later. But two, it's fantastic market research, which will tell you what to start producing content on. You could start developing thought leadership around their biggest obstacles, around what they're excited about, around what their boss is asking them for. You can start building relationships with the people who are influencing them, right? So they'll just tell you, oh, it's Chris Walker. Oh, and that's how, like, when we asked a bunch of B2B marketers that question, of course, Chris Walker was one of the big ones. We're like, oh, we should probably build a bigger relationship with him, right? Because the more we can do that, the more we'll be in front of our ideal buyers. And then where do they hear from them? Because then they'll tell you what channels to be in, because you're asking them directly over and over again. Where do you hear from the most your most influential people from? You're like, oh, there's some ideas on channels to go hit with paid media as well as your short form content. And then it becomes about testing, right? Slowly but surely getting used to the platforms, and then testing your content with them. I can go into details like how to do it with podcasting versus how to do it with LinkedIn. So it's different per platform, but generally it's testing it and doing a volume of content, I think, is the thing that most people miss. And if you're going to do a volume of content, that means you kind of have to loosen a little bit on what is good or what is perfect. You have to kind of throw perfect out the window and think progress before perfection. So
Dan, let's,
you have to let people go.
So let's get tactical. Cassidy, I don't know if we're ready to get tactical. I'm looking at our time here, and we can probably keep Dan all day, but let's go tactical for a second. Like, so let's say you've done some of that good market research. You've got some really great hypotheses. You want to do podcast and LinkedIn, or you want to do some combination of what you believe is the best short form and long form kind of channels, et cetera. You just mentioned something that was unspecific, and I want to get more specific on it. You were talking about like a volume of content, testing, experimenting. Yep. Walk us through like what framework would you use with like your consulting clients or, you know, with Element 451. What is a good starting point? I'm starting on LinkedIn. What does an experiment look like? How long, how much content is appropriate to really get a good pulse? What signals are you looking for? Like, get as tactical as you can here now on just like that framework of like maybe the first 3 to 6 months of starting to build an audience on a channel.
So once you kind of have an idea of what topics you want to talk to, or what's most likely going to resonate with your buyers, because these are the problems you know they run, these are the things that they're excited about, you start to craft. Like, and you have to sit down with your subject matter experts to be able to find the answers to these. Even better if you have someone who's like fairly competent at producing media, who's a subject matter expert. This is why hiring an influencer and bringing them in-house is such a good hire, because they usually have a little bit of both and can do this well. But on LinkedIn, it's posting. In the very beginning, I'd probably be posting at least 3 times a day, every day, 7 days a week for 90 days.
Wow.
Like, if this is going hard.
Yeah.
Chris Walker did freaking more.
Yeah.
He was doing 10 posts a day for who knows how long. And maybe not every day, but like he was throwing out a volume of content. I went from like 1,000 followers to like 10,000 followers in 5 months because I was posting three times a day for two or three times a day for about 5 months. If you show up to a new city and you don't know anyone, but you start showing up to every single party and not just showing up, but working the room, shaking hands, getting to know people, being interesting and being interested in others, you're probably going to have a lot of friends in 3 months. It's the same way with LinkedIn. Not only do you post all the content, but you show up in everybody else's comments and you start to build friends really quickly. That's the thing I love most about LinkedIn. It's a very conversational platform versus Twitter, which is really about, it's about conversation there too, but it's about coming up with the hits that go viral. That's the game that Twitter is like crafting virality versus in LinkedIn, you're trying to craft conversations with your post and with the comments when you're in the people's comments. That's the best way you can do it, which makes it easier without having an audience somewhere else. You can actually like just literally just engage with more people and you'll build more of an audience.
So even for somebody like me who like posts, I mean, sporadically and sometimes, you know, sometimes I'll get into waves where I'm pretty consistent and stuff. And I've built up a little bit of a following over the last 2 years. Like that is very ambitious to jump to that much volume. This is me just speaking for myself here. Like, I don't know, how do you come up with that much content and like things to say, you know, like sometimes I struggle to just like sit down and come up with a post for the day, you know?
Yep. This is how I did it. There is more ways to do it now with AI because AI is pretty good now. Nowadays you can feed AI one blog post you wrote and it will write 10 tweets for you or 10 LinkedIn posts. And they're actually pretty good. And they're still in your voice because it's based on your blog post. So at Sweetfish, we had an evangelism program and I had a dedicated writer doing nothing but writing content for me and a few other evangelists. And that was Emily. Her name was DeBrito. Then now it's Brady.
Yeah, I remember Emily.
So she's fantastic. She left Sweetfish to become full-time mom, which I respect the heck out of. Yeah. So she's not as active on LinkedIn anymore, which is, she was cranking out great content. But before she became an evangelist herself, she was writing content for everybody else. That's how she got so good. And she would write a 1/3 of my content, about 5 posts a week. That helped. I would focus on writing one really good post a week or one post a day. So a lot of my attention in the morning would be writing that one post. And then the third post would always be a layup for me. It would always be like that thing that I saw somewhere else that I would repost and then add my thoughts to. And it literally could be a repost to someone else's post or a screenshot of this thing or this random thing, news article that I take a screenshot of and give some thoughts on. But it was like a layup post in late afternoon just for extra. And sometimes it'd be a huge hit. Like you never know what's going to work. But in the first 90 days, it's about learning and growing and figuring out and developing essentially. There's a huge shift taking place from creatives to creators. Creatives know how to make content, but creators are rapidly trying to experiment to develop a discernment of what's going to work. Mr. Beast could lose it all and be wildly successful within a year. Not because of the audience he has, but because of even if he didn't use his face and had to use someone else as the face, his level of discernment of what's going to resonate with people is so strong that he would be wildly successful again. That's what you're trying to build as someone who's trying to build an audience is that discernment, which means you need a volume because you just need more practice. Yeah.
I wasn't going to ask this question or go down this path, but like let's dig in a little bit more just selfishly for Carl and I for a second. How did you keep up with that volume yourself? Even once a day, maybe 6 times a week. Like, did you have like, now I feel like Tim Ferriss. Did you get into like what was your habit here? Did you have like a Asana board where you kept ideas or a notebook or?
You have to get more tactical, Dan, than time blocking. So
yes, time blocking for sure. I mean, because luckily I worked at a company that gave me time on paid time to do this. And it was good for them because I think through my LinkedIn, I could probably attribute about $1 million in revenue to Sweetfish just from my personal LinkedIn over the course of 3 years. So well worth the investment from Sweetfish. But I spent about 1.5 hours of work every day just working LinkedIn. I probably spent another 1.5 hours in the mornings commenting and writing content. I'd also spend time on blocks in the weekend writing ahead of the week so that I didn't have to do it every single day. at least for every single post, because again, I'm posting three times a day. I could have one post in the hopper for every day at least, and then another one from Emily that she would write for me based on other things I had said and repurpose it. And then I'd have to worry about the layup post, which was usually pretty easy. But it's a lot, most of the time is actually just spent in the comments.
Yeah, the comments.
And engaging really with influencers, yeah. Engaging with peers, and engaging with people that are below you that are maybe becoming friends of yours that are trying to follow your path and you trying to help them up, because it kind of becomes the 360, right? Some people from above you help you. And I was engaging with Justin Welsh and Austin Belsack and Chris Walker a lot, you know, still do sometimes. And sometimes they'd come and show up in my post and give me a boost. Oh, that's one interesting way. If you're a company and you're listening to this, you're like, well, how do I go faster? If you have one person on your team with an audience, it makes a massive difference. For me, that was James Carberry in the beginning. LinkedIn's weird, and that one comment from somebody with a following is a huge, huge advantage.
Yep.
They don't even have to share your post, just come and comment.
Yep.
Because every time James came and commented on my early post, I was getting 50, 60 comments from the beginning because James was showing up on my comments every day. Because he also liked what I had to say. So it wasn't just, you know, bad posts. They were good posts. It's almost like a trampoline, right? If you ever jumped on a kid on a trampoline, if you had the big kid come and jump next to you right before you hit the mat, it would like launch you, right? And you'd go up. LinkedIn's the same way. If you have someone with a bigger following come and hit your post, and I've had a number of people that have showed up on my post, like Chris, a few, very rarely, but Chris would sometimes show up, and then that would help. But Justin Welsh, Austin Belsack a few times. He's got like a million followers, so that was always a big one. But then Dale Dupree and even a bunch of people with like 30 to 40,000 in that range, like Nick Bennett would show up. And if a bunch of those people show up and comment, you're going to have a hit. You're going to have a viral post because like four or five people with 50K followers showed up on your post and added their 2 cents.
So Dan,
we always joke about the, Carl, we always joke about the Chris Walker impact. Hey, like Chris commented on somebody at one of our team's posts and you can just see it take off. And it's like the running joke.
And
how do we get
it's huge. If Chris has commented on a few of your posts, then you're doing better than me. So I still can't convince the guy to go and comment on one of my posts. So your track record.
You kind of have to bait him in. You know what I'm saying? Like you have to make it all about, like the last time I talked about the audience growth ceiling, which is another, gosh, we could talk about that too. And I was like, I think Chris is wrong on why less people are engaging with him. And so the post was kind of like responding to something he said at the beginning of the post. And then I laid into my hypothesis. Naturally, what do people start do? They start tagging him over and over again. So if you can create the talk conversation about him and people start tagging him 100 times, he's probably going to show up. I've done it a few times now.
To summarize,
not intentionally. I just knew it would be a good content though.
To summarize what you just said, you just need to piss off Chris and then he will show up in your comment section. So
I think I'd always try to write it in a way that I never try to piss people off. I try to be careful with that, but I try to be balanced and being like, hey, I think there's a different explanation here. So if you go and read the post where I get Chris to show up, it's never like in a combative way where I'm just looking to throw fists. It's always kind of like, have you considered, you know, this? I feel like LinkedIn's really good at that compared to other social platforms where people are just generally nicer and willing to change opinions and actually have conversations. And I love that.
Yeah, I agree with that. I do, for the remaining time, want to hit on audience plateau, audience, you know,
ceiling.
The audience growth ceiling.
I'd love to hear your thoughts on how to, it is definitely a thing. I'd love to hear your thoughts on like how you identify it and break through it.
Start with, I discovered it because I was playing around with some growth models. We had found out how to unlock audience growth through programmatic ads of all things. I could, by targeting down programmatic ads and making it really narrow and doing some other cool things with retargeting pixels to get, find out who are the kinds of people who respond to these kinds of ads that are a call to action, subscribe to a podcast. I found we could guarantee audience growth for about $5 a paid a subscriber on Apple Podcasts. So for $5,000, I could generate 1,000, you know, new followers to an Apple Podcast show. So I'm like, okay, with that kind of predictability, what are we running into? And I just started running through the Excel sheet. I'm like, okay, well, we can grow like this, but you know, that you would think it'd be a linear curve, but then you have to account for churn. There's always going to be churn because you've experienced it yourself with your own favorite creators. How many people have you subscribed to, listened for a long time, and then you unsubscribe because you felt like, you know, you learned it all. You've graduated from their content, right? There's always going to be churn. So let's imagine, just for funsies, we gain 100 new people every single month, and we have a churn rate of 10%. We're losing 10% every month. Where's our ceiling? 1,000 people. Because at 1,000 people, no matter how many new 100 subscribers I get, I'm always going to lose 100 every month, right? So you have an audience growth ceiling of 1,000 people. If you're gaining 100 and losing 100 every month, that churn rate's always going to work against you. So now if we kind of intuitively understand that's what's going on with the audience growth ceiling, that's cool. Now we can actually start to make modifications based on that. And that's when I get into like what I call the audience growth pillars. The first one's acquisition. What can we do to gain more, to increase our 100 that we're getting every single month? What are all the different ways we can leverage paid, owned, and earned in order to increase acquisition? Because that will increase our audience growth ceiling. More importantly, what can we do to retain them longer? You can just walk through like Never Lose a Customer Again by Joey Coleman and just take these principles for customers and apply them to audience growth. So ask the how can we activate them and onboard new audience better? How can we acclimate them and help them build habits around listening and engaging with us? How can we help them accomplish a small but meaningful win early now that they're part of our audience? And I'd like to even ask the question, how do we graduate them, knowing that some people will learn everything we have to learn and we need to be repetitive in what we say because there'll always be new people for the message. Like Chris Walker's message is still as good as it was 3 years ago, even though some people are tired of hearing it. There's still people fighting, most people I'd argue are still fighting over capturing demand instead of generating it. So there's still new audience to be had there. At the same time, there's some people that have learned everything they can from Chris to some degree and need to graduate. Like, what can we be doing to graduate people out and make them feel good about, hey, you've made it to a certain level, go and do the next thing. Maybe even making recommendations on the next thing. Random idea I've had that I'm still working on.
Well, Dan, what are some of those examples though? Because honestly, like I don't, when you say these things, I'm like, those sound awesome, but I don't even know how you would do something like that. So like, how do you onboard? How do you graduate? How do you help them have a small win in something like a podcast channel? Because like, you don't have like a ton of control, right? Necessarily. So are you talking about like having like an email subscription as well? Like in it?
Absolutely.
Or like, what are some of those really like, you know, actionable strategies to do some of those things better?
With a podcast, my first recommendation would be having a start here thing. And it depends on what your industry is. And I was working with a big brand that has a large audience around like health for mothers. It just happens to be local in Nashville. And I was talking to them because they have a massive audience. You're talking like hundreds of thousands audience, but they're trying to increase their audience growth ceiling. I'm like, hey, instead of trying to acquire more, why don't you just onboard your people coming in every day and onboard them better? And for them, it's like, we needed a start here. Like and you could plug this into every episode, like, hey, you new to the channel? If you're brand new, thanks for joining. You should go to this URL right now to get started on this thing. It's the easiest thing you can do to improve this thing that we're talking about. Mm. Right. And having a start here thing, that's some kind of, and I would capture a lead and get them onto an email list, preferably a newsletter of some kind, but there's going to be a welcome sequence that helps them walk through your basics. Like Chris, this is my biggest beef with Chris, is that he needs this desperately. He needs a place that walks people through the basics of his core message. He's not doing this. And I'm like, oh, so much money left on the table, because how many people need to go back through the basics of lead gen versus demand gen?
Yeah.
He repeats it a lot, but if you get just caught in the wrong episode or listen to two episodes in a row, he's probably not going to say it. So he needs an activation guide to get people on the fast track and to experience a quick win earlier. Right. So it's really just a simple onboarding sequence, going through your main message, even a little indoctrination where you properly define the villain that you're fighting, right? And why this works really well. So simple email onboarding sequence is the easiest way.
Dude, that was an awesome.
How do you acclimate people and build habits though? I think that's where you can get really excited. Gary Vee's really good at this with building habits, right? Because he's pushed really hard to be like the first comment. So he rewards people for being the first. He did for a while anyway. He's like, first comment on Instagram, because he knew that was driving results on Instagram. He's like, first comment, this is what I'm giving away. First comment, this is what I'm giving away. Again, he's trying to build habits. Justin Welsh, freaking master at getting people to hit his post hard first. I'm there showing up at 7:14 in the morning. I know he's dropping a post. I'm literally refreshing my feed, waiting for it. There's at least a dozen other people were doing the exact same thing to be the first comment on Justin Welsh's post. He's trained me to habitually show up and at 7:14 to be the first substantial comment on his post because it's part of his course. So he's built a habit of his audience to do that. It's why he continues to grow. So those are some examples. Let me jump into the last two pillars really quick before we go.
Yeah.
One is elevation. And I didn't write the book on this, but how do you get your audience base to be deeper level, not just casual audience, but deep committed fans? Pat Flynn wrote an awesome book on super fans, pretty much has the step-by-step guide on this. How do you get them? How do you get casual audience to become super fans? It's a fascinating book. And then last pillar is monetization. Like, how do you actually take this massive audience you're building and actually make money out of it?
So what were the three pillars, Dan? Refresh them, summarize them.
Four pillars.
Four pillars.
Are acquisition, retention, elevation, and monetization. All things that you need to do in order to lift your audience growth ceiling is kind of like, if I had a diagram in front of you, it's kind of like four pillars, ceiling, right? Because that's what we're trying to lift, is this audience growth ceiling. You need them all to work together in order to build an actual audience. So that's kind of my philosophy. I'm still very early in even talking about these things on LinkedIn. Probably take a crack at writing a book on it this summer to publish for free and probably make a dedicated podcast for people to just go and listen to, just to try to get more content out there on it and start documenting the process of how I'm doing it for Element 451. So that's the goal. That's the dream. I might have some hypothesis in there, but yeah, awesome. I'm feeling pretty good about it.
I'm gonna sneak one more in. I know we're bumping up against time. Monetization. Do you look at it as in direct versus indirect, or kind of what's your philosophy on kind of monetizing the audience in terms of like directly monetizing it, indirectly monetizing it? Do you have a framework in your head of how you think through that, even if it's early days?
There's so many ways to do it, but the first thing you have to do is take the monetization hat off for a little bit and focus just on building an audience. Right? Because that's the first thing that kills most companies. They're focused on content marketing, and they need to take the marketing out and just focus on the content. If you try to monetize it too early, you're going to kill it. So, but provided you got something going, there's so many ways to monetize it. The first is, like, if you're building a separate media brand, this is what Sweetfish is getting into. I like to separate the corporate brand from the media brand, because that's a whole nother podcast, but having a separate media channels than your corporate channels. You can start essentially making your corporate brand a sponsor of the media brand. You can do advertorials. You know, we did a whole podcast series on B2B growth with Vidyard on how they're doing this, and they've laid a fantastic way of how they're doing. They're using multiple things. Like, they're putting some Vidyard ads in their content, but they're also creating like tutorials that are very video, personal video centric, right? So they're trying to get sales reps to understand the ideals of personal video. And of course, they'll have little hooks, little call to actions that go back to the Vidyard brand saying, oh, come read this blog post on this sales thing on our Vidyard brand that's more tightly close to like video, right? And being personal, right? So they have all these little hooks that they're laying for Vidyard in their, sales feed media brand. And I think you can do that heavy. You can be light and kind of go back and forth and find like a good middle ground. I think people will figure it out. They're not dumb. They'll figure out where it's coming from, but there's lots of ways to lay hooks in, especially once you get people in the newsletter, where you can really start to, you know, stick a bunch of hooks going back to your corporate brand within your newsletter. But just imagine if, like, what's the current media brand that has your audience's attention? How would you monetize it if you had bought it? Think about how HubSpot's doing it with The Hustle. There's a case study right there of how they're monetizing it already.
That's good stuff, man. I look forward to the book. You should definitely write it. I think I'd love to see you post some more about this on LinkedIn too. So selfishly, of course, so I can learn from you. Anything else, Carl?
Man, that's it. This is awesome. I don't know if I've smashed the bell button, Dan, on your LinkedIn profile, honestly, embarrassingly enough. I need to just like go do that, because I don't feel like I see a lot of your content, and I definitely, that's a mistake. So this was
smash
awesome.
It.
Yeah.
Maybe it'll help you out, Carl.
Yeah, maybe it'll help me. I'll be the first commenter on all Dan's posts now.
Dan, I assume everybody can find you on, where can everybody find you? LinkedIn, what else?
Yep, linkedin.com/IN/digitalmarketingDan and danchez.com.
Love it. Thanks for your time, man. This has been awesome.
Thanks, Dan.
Audience is going to appreciate
Thanks
it.
Thanks for having me. Yeah.
All right, everybody. We're out. Carl, have a good day. Dan, have a good day. Yep. I'll see you guys later.
All right. See you, gents.